Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, I am going to start off with a letter that is a follow-up to a follow-up that is from Robert in Maryland. And Robert and I have been conversing via the Ask Dr. Dawn website about a friend of his in Switzerland who is having puzzling neurological symptoms and was looking for a functional medicine doctor. I gave him some suggestions, but then one of our regular listeners who lives in Switzerland called in, or rather emailed in, the following week with a whole list of functional medicine doctors in Switzerland to pass on to that patient. And so I just am reminding Robert that we sent you that email information. So I hope you've received it and by now, and that you can share that with John. But as usual, what happens in these complicated cases is Robert has added something very interesting. He says, I'd like to add that in puzzling John about his neurological GI symptoms, he shared he had multiple parasitic infections while traveling Europe. When I asked what labs confirmed and what treatments were rendered, he informed me that there were no labs and only Cipro was used to treat. I feel this may have left a hole in his treatment plan. Well, Robert, I'd have to say I agree with you on that. Furthermore, Robert says maybe that could be the catalyst for his years of GI symptoms, including a diagnosis of Crohn's. I mentioned the possible leaky gut tie to his neurological condition and asked had he had an EEG temporal lobe study. His response was negative EEG, but not any length to which I had hoped for when he was, so it wasn't done when he was having neurological symptoms, I think is what Robert's trying to say. In general, Robert, a sleep-deprived EEG, even if the person hasn't had any strange neurologic phenomenon for a while, if it is a brain-originated problem, there's usually a kind of fingerprint in the brainwaves on a sleep-deprived EEG, which tells us that that is the problem. And of course, EEG is electroencephalogram, encephalo being some version of Latin for brain. So I will continue just with thank you for your assistance, a hopeful Bob Tiger. And Robert, we are also hopeful for your friend out there in Switzerland. So while we're on the topic of that letter, treating a parasitic infection with antibiotics usually takes high doses and a long time. The sorts of parasites that, well, for example, Borrelia burgdorferi or Lyme disease, I wouldn't be surprised if those were the kind of parasites, Anaplasma, Ehrlichiosis, that he might have been treated for. They are parasites. But those would be the kind of things I would expect to be found in Europe. I don't know whether our gentleman in distress had any tropical travel. That's where you pick up the really interesting parasites with complex life cycles that they love to test you on in the medical boards. But I won't bore you with some of those weird lifestyles. They are well and truly strange, however. I also hope not bore you with is some updates. And one thing that I thought was particularly helpful for patients was there are medicines that you can just get rid of. Now, old medicines, your medicine cabinet, you probably know about that. And you know you can drop those off at the pharmacies. They have a bin for those. We like to try to keep them from being flushed toilet or put in the landfill because, you know, the problem with that is it ends up in the water table and there's plenty of drug in the water table now. But remember all those daily baby aspirin, anyone over 50 to protect your heart? Well, both the U.S. Preventative Services Health Task Force and the American Geriatric Society have added aspirin to the list that's inappropriate to older adults. And basically what the new advice is that the risk, if you're 60 and you have not had a heart attack and you haven't had a stroke, the risks of bleeding from aspirin, including GI bleeding, actually outweigh the cardiovascular benefits. Now, that's not true if you've already had a heart attack or stroke by the age of 60. In that case, aspirin is useful for secondary prevention. But for those of you who are at average risk and over 60, that aspirin is probably going to do you more harm than good. And so that's one to stop. Another thing is phenylephrine. In about 2006, after we were getting into the Breaking Bad days where people were making methamphetamine out of pseudoephedrine, the pharmacies took the pseudoephedrine off of the shelves and they put them behind the counter so that you had to actually ask for them. And what that did was tank the sales of pseudoephedrine. So as a result, the company started using phenylephrine. But phenylephrine is no more effective than a placebo. And this was basically came out of the FDA in 2023. The reason it's so thoroughly absorbed and broken down in the gut that it doesn't get into your general circulation, it's broken down by your gut, by your microbiome. So it never has a chance to make it to your nose. No better than placebo. I'm not recommending a pseudoephedrine except under very specific circumstances for people, because it can speed up your heart rate, can make you a little speedy, and I think it can, there's certainly data that too much of it, or it can bioaccumulate. The older you are, the more likely you're not going to empty the sink before you add more drugs, so to speak, so you're going to overflow. And people don't break down drugs as quickly, so they need to use lower doses. They bioaccumulate more readily. So that's one to stay away from. Nasal lavage and rinsing. I find that you don't want to use zinc spray, but I do find that silver spray, and of course Chinese herbs are very good at symptom control for colds. But if you're, let's say, under 50 and don't have a heart condition, sure, some Sudafed can help you, among other things, get through your radio broadcast without sneezing or blowing your nose. All right, so another thing to kind of chuck in the trash can is Colace, which really doesn't work better than placebo. And Senna and Colace really are not really all that good. I think it's dose-related, so we have to watch on that one. Older adults are strongly recommended to avoid Benadryl or diphenhydramine, and that's again bioaccumulation. It's already a kind of long-acting drug, and it lasts longer and longer the older you are, and it has definitely been shown to contribute to falls. There's also some studies from England in particular that suggest that perhaps it might contribute to dementia. So I'm saying diphenhydramine off the list. If you have insomnia, try something else. Stay away from that stuff if you're over 60. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about a few other things, but let me just throw out the other big news, which is if you're older and you have high blood pressure, you should stay away from beta blockers. Those used to be first-line therapy, and research has shown that they're actually more risky. Now, I will say, to be fair, when they became first-line therapy, it was like 30 years ago, and many of the drugs that have come on down, off of the assembly line and onto production since then are just much better. So they've been replaced. And so for high blood pressure, you really want to go after the angiotensin pathway. So you want angiotensin receptor blockers or angiotensin inhibitors. You don't really want those beta blockers except under some very specific circumstances. And it's important, I think, for people to take a look at their meds, take a look. I would recommend looking at these Beers criteria. If you go to the American Geriatric Society website, They have a lot of really, really excellent advice. And just like we're learning that there's a big difference between men and women in terms of their physiology, there's a big difference between 30-something and 70-something in terms of their physiology. And we need to be doing our research and doing our clearing and validation of drugs in sub-cohorts by sex and age if we really expect to be able to say that this drug X is safe and effective across the board. Well, we're going to stop. It is time to introduce the guests in the studio. I have here Mira Achilles, who is a novice to KSQD. I have a nefarious plan to get her involved.
Yay.
But she is my lovely assistant, administrative assistant at my office. Everybody loves Mira. She is fantastic and has really helped me improve the quality of my service in the time she's been working for me and become a really good friend. So Mira's here in her capacity as friend. Say hi.
Hello.
So I asked you what you thought would be on the minds of your friends. How did you source these questions? What did you do?
So I thought about which of my peers shows up for themselves in a physical way and a mental way, and which of those folks would be interested in getting their questions answered. And I reached out to them and got some wonderful responses.
All right. Well, I gave you the choice of which ones to read, and I have answers. I had to do actually, they were good questions. I had to do an actual little homework to be sure I could answer them succinctly and thoroughly at the same time. So hit me.
All right. Well, since we're sitting here at a desk, let's start with what would support my focus most as someone with ADHD at a desk job?
Okay. And I thought that was an excellent question. The data, I'm very big on data, show us that cognitive behavioral therapy and exercise are the two things that really, really work. And so let's talk about what that means when I say cognitive behavioral therapy and what that would look like. And there are online sessions, and, you know, you can join an online group that's even discontinuous in time and probably get a reasonable bargain basement version of assistance with this. And I'm sure that there are also books and workshops and all sorts of things. So we're just going to kind of say that typically, you're looking at 8 to 12 hours of work, and the work is divided into just techniques, kind of like if you were going to learn a sport, let's say, let's pick tennis, you know, you would spend an hour working on your serve, and maybe another hour working on your backhand, and then another hour working on close to the net, and then another hour working on, you know, just the techniques and the tactics of playing tennis and so on. So tactic number one is time management. And that means using calendars, agendas, to-do lists. And now with these phones that we carry around, it's very easy to have reminders and alerts and pings and all sorts of things coming at you from your phone. And I'm very big on index cards because those work for me. And so something along these lines where you have cards, what have I got to get done today? Mm-hmm. And then you shuffle them by importance because there's two ways. Things are either really important and really urgent, or they're really important and not really urgent, or they're not really important and urgent. And they're not really important and not urgent. So you can throw those last 25% out the window. And then as far as the really important and not urgent, or really, you know, as far as you're concerned, not that one, the one where it's somebody else's urgency, basically. That's what you have to figure out. Because those you can kind of back, or because if they're really important to somebody else will do them. And they're just trying to make you do them. So once you've gotten the really important, you work on the urgents and get those out of the way. And then you look at the you look at the urgence and non-importance and really get picky about whether you need to even do this at all. And then, so that leaves you with the important and not urgent, and you chip away at those. So I've checked off one box on the six things of the really important but not urgent, like maybe applying for graduate school by July 15th. All right, I got the application. I got page one done. Good. All right, check that box. And then you're creating a reward loop for yourself. You got that done. You are responsible. You're good. You rock. So setting up small little reward loops. And that goes to the next thing, which is breaking down complex tasks into manageable steps and then going through the steps and checking them off as you do them. Because what happens with ADHD is you get distracted and you lose your place, and then the whole thing looks so massive that you go off into a kind of collapse, crisis, gibbering, apprehension in the corner, which is a total waste of your time. You could be at least working on something that's a little less emotionally devastating, like your grocery list, and getting that done. Save that time for that later. But being able to task switch when something seems too complex, step back, how can I break this down? So these are management tasks that any person who's worked in business has to develop. But for people with ADD, they can apply these methods to their entire life. Another one is managing distraction. And that is really a matter of getting your scientific clipboard and looking around at the environment and saying, I need to close that window. I need to put a curtain there. I need to take these posters off the wall. I need to have my field of vision be the thing I need to be working on. And you probably do need to test your own attention span. So exactly how long is your attention span on something you really are interested and committed to? And when you lose it, hit the stopwatch and say, okay, I held it for 12 minutes. Okay, so you have a 10-minute attention span. Now, that's how you're going to break your tasks up. You're going to break it up into, I'm going to work on this for 10 minutes, and then I'll switch and work on this for 10 minutes, and then I'll take a walk, and then I'll come back and I'll work on A for 10 minutes. And you acknowledge your short attention span, but code switch, basically. But you design it. You do it on purpose. You've got a deliberate plan. Like, okay, I'm on this task. Now I'm on this task. I'm on this task. And it's right out there in front of you. Where am I now? Oh, I'm here. So that you know where to go next. You don't waste any time thinking about it. You just drop into it and roll. And really modifying modifying environmental factors. And that really means I would turn off my Wi-Fi at work. You know, I would let the emails and whatever's coming through on my desktop or my laptop, but I wouldn't look at any of the alerts. I'd turn them all off. Turn off the notifications when you hit your desk, on all your social media. When you leave, you turn them back on. But you are not a person, if you have ADHD, you're not a person who can handle those distractions. And you'll just get sucked into the quicksand and not accomplish what you need. So it's like flossing, you know? It's just like flossing. It's nobody wants to floss. I'm tired. I'm sleepy. I'm late. No, floss. Do it. Just do it. Quit whining. So systematically articulating problems. Notice, again, pull out that clipboard. Well, that sure didn't work. What went wrong? I picked up the phone. Somebody interrupted me. I didn't have my office door closed. Something shiny walked by. What went wrong? Now what can I do so that that doesn't go wrong next time? And so being a little more self-aware when you fail and taking a moment to deconstruct what drove that failure, because it wasn't your intention to fail. So something tripped you up, and you remove the obstacles as they occur. And then the last one, this is the one where you really need a buddy. I don't think this is something people can do on their own, because you've got to have people call you on your doo-doo. You know, you're saying you have negative self-talk, you have negative self-beliefs, and you keep saying them to yourself. You know, I'm stupid, I'm no good, I can't do this. And the fact of the matter is, it's not that you can't do it, it's just that you haven't yet done it. And so you really need an outside person to repeat it back to you and say, do you really think that? Is that really true? Or is that just, are you just echoing what your dad said to you, you know, 20 years ago when he was annoyed at you for breaking his wrench or whatever?
Yeah.
It's hard to break a wrench. I should have come up with a better example.
Or that teacher that won't leave you alone.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's go to exercise, because this has strong data. And there's a study where they did a 12-week structured exercise program that was called the START intervention. And it improved ADHD symptoms with an effect size of 0.93. That's almost like cutting the ADD in half.
Wow.
And they've done other studies. And basically, if you exercise, it improves the blood flow to the front of your brain, which is the part that you're jacking up with the ADD drugs in the first place, if you need them. So you get more prefrontal cortex, which is what controls the distraction. So you feed the part of your brain that should be, you know, the conductor and is, you know, off having a cigarette break. So you basically feed it, bring it back to the table. And so moderate intense aerobic activity should be a regular component. And then the last thing, some incredible number, like 80% of adults with ADHD have sleep disturbances. And most of them have what's called delayed sleep-wake timing. So essentially, they're in Hawaii. They don't get sleepy until 2 a.m. And they are not awake at 8 a.m. They're jet-lagged. They're chronically jet-lagged. They're in the wrong time zone. And so what you have to do is jet-lag therapy, which is circadian dysfunction therapy. And people with ADHD are uniquely, they need external cues. So that means a bedtime that you stick to and a wake-up time that you stick to. And that even on the weekends. And what I tell people is you have to get up at whatever time you have to get up on Monday, you have to get up on Sunday at that time. Get out, get 15 minutes of light in your eyes, and then you can go back to bed. And you can sleep until noon. But you have set the clock so that you'll be sleepy at the appropriate time that night. Because once the clock's set, it just keeps ticking. It's a 16-hour clock. So bright light in the morning is indisputably the most important piece of this, in my opinion. And evening light restriction. When we went away from incandescence and we moved to screens, we changed the light that was getting to our brains. It's bluer. It's more like morning light. We're trained on morning light, wake up. And so it keeps us awake. That's why it's so important. You can use a little low-dose melatonin, but it won't work if you're looking at a screen. It won't do anything. You have to be, I tell people, get amber-colored glasses and put them on at 7 p.m. And if you're going to do screens, do it with those glasses on. Your brain will do the color adjust pretty quickly. It's kind of amazing. So I have a motto for your friend, which is get up, get light, get sweaty, and then go to work.
I love that.
Nice.
Get up, get light, and get sweaty. Why even use that as my sign-off?
<That's> perfect.
So back to our lovely Mira Achilles and her next favorite question from the younger generation.
So our next question is, should I be avoiding ice baths or really cold showers when I'm in my luteal phase or specifically on my period?
All right. Now, that was a crazy question. I mean, not crazy in a bad way, but just coming a fairly esoteric question. So let's start with cold water immersion, which is what an ice bath is. And there is a ton of hype out there in the internet and, you know, the ice bucket challenge that started a while back to the other things that show up on the internet. Not all of that stuff is true, okay? So there is some data that there are metabolic effects. The concept is that cold exposure is going to stimulate brown adipose tissue, and that's going to help you burn more calories, and that's going to be good for you. So it seems logical, you know, improve insulin sensitivity, la, la, la. However, there was a study, a well-done study, in 2025 that had 16 daily 10-minute sessions of 14 degree centigrade. And what they found was surprising. It decreased glucose tolerance and decreased insulin sensitivity. And so it completely backfired. It actually made people more pre-diabetic. And when they stopped doing this at the end of the 16 days of the trial, it took a week for the effect for them to revert back to their baseline.
Wow.
So was that too big a dose, too frequent a dose? Maybe a lower dose would have worked. Maybe you needed a higher dose. A lot of it's anecdotal, and when you actually do something like this, of course, you can't have a placebo, but still, it suggests that we shouldn't just assume that because it makes sense physiologically that it's actually going to happen. In terms of the studies that are out there, they're small and they use different protocols, something. So it might be 7 degrees centigrade for 30 seconds or 15 degrees for 2 hours. And you can't, it's all total apples to oranges. So we don't have good data. It does cause vasoconstriction, and women in the luteal phase, because of their progesterone levels, are going to have a harder time with cold exposure. So they're going to get more vasoconstriction. I get bad vasoconstriction in my hands. It's called Raynaud's syndrome. I would never dream of doing a cold plunge because my hands are going to feel like they're on fire because they are starving of oxygen, and it's not a good feeling. When you're in the luteal phase, which is when your estrogen and progesterone peak, you might shiver more readily. But they've looked at fuel utilization, like when you're in cold exposure, does it change whether you're burning protein or burning fat? It doesn't do anything. And so basically, there isn't a lot of data that in humans that creates a problem. If you put a rat in a cold room for a long period of time, it messes up their periods, their estrous cycles. But that's a long way. But there's some risks with cold immersion, and how long you do it is, I think, in her case, the question was, did she specifically give the timing on that question?
There was no timing specified.
So let's just walk through what happens with cold water. First of all, you know, the Pacific Ocean out there is cold. Rapid cooling basically interferes with your ability to swim. But when you first hit really cold water, like minus 15, minus 12, there's a gasp and a hyperventilation, and then high blood pressure. It lasts about 30 seconds. But that's the initial physiologic response. That involuntary gasping from the hyperventilation, if you're underwater or you're completely submerged, you are probably going to inhale water, which is why when people drop into the sea in colder water, you have very little time to get to them. And if they don't have a jacket on, they probably will be drowned before you get to them, because they take in a lethal amount of water, which is about 1.5 liters.
Wow.
And that's enough to kill you. And then the heart, when the face gets immerged, it creates what's called autonomic conflict. So your parasympathetic response is tweaked, and your sympathetic response is tweaked. They're both amplified at the same time. And that's really, really bad, because when they're arm wrestling, your heart doesn't know which way to beat. And so you get cardiac arrhythmias. It's just not a good idea. And hypothermia is very difficult, and it is the heart that kills you with hypothermia, because it's when you actually rewarming is the most dangerous thing there is. Because if you rewarm someone's surface, it's tricky. Because let's suppose they've been out there in the snow, and you dig them out, and they've still got a heartbeat, and you bring them in, and you rewarm them. They're going to warm from the outside in. And what that's going to do is crash their blood pressure, because they're going to vasodilate on the surface, and then the blood is going to have to be averaged out across a larger vascular bed. So there is, you know, so the pressure, the overall pressure of the blood's going to drop. And that might be enough to starve the brain or starve the heart. So rewarming, get a little medical here. You'll do enemas, to warm water enemas, because you can get the water up into the gut, and that is warming the core. And you want to warm the core first in order to rewarm successfully.
Wow.
So lots of interesting, and this is what I love about these questions, is they take you off on these tangential but rather interesting little factoids.
Absolutely.
All right, next question.
All right, now we're going to skip ahead. Why do some people faint when seeing needles or blood draws? Is it purely physical, or is there something psychological going on?
It is both, as you might expect, because there's a conditioning effect. So we'll talk about the physiological first, and this is the needle response. Seeing a needle or having a needle poked into you, especially, is it creates a reflex called the vasovagal response, and there's actually a vascular response that's reflex mediated from the nerves in the vein that just got poked. And what this does is it lowers your sympathetic tone. So it's going to lower your blood pressure just a priori when that's one of the reasons they're so careful when people donate blood, because that's a big old needle and it's in for a while. And so there's lots of potential for faints and falls with blood donation, but we also see it with vaccination. Even the people who are most likely to faint from a vaccination are young women.
Hmm.
Once you hit puberty and for the next 10 years, you are at the highest risk for fainting when you get a shot.
Wow.
And of course, that's when we give Gardasil to,
exactly.
You know, or Cervarix or one of our HPV vaccines, which, by the way, parenthetically, HPV vaccines rock. They have eliminated cervical cancer in literally hundreds of thousands of women. They've eradicated their risk. At least for the moment, it is now a rare disease. It used to be so common that we would check women for this cancer or precancer every year, because it would hit young women and it would take about 10 years and then it would be incurable. So if you didn't find it, and we were all used to going in for your annual exam, and I was very good at doing annual exams, still am, but even when you're good at it and you're careful and you talk to the patient and you warm the speculum, it's still not fun.
No.
It's just not. And so getting back to normally, when you have normally what would happen when you were wounded would be that you would have a increase in your heart rate and probably a slight increase in your blood pressure from the pain and the fear. What happens in vasovagal sympathy is that you activate your you overactivate your parasympathetic, which is your rest and digest, and you turn off your fight or flight. So you get an inverse. You get a drop in your blood pressure because you've turned off fight or flight. And you get a drop in your heart rate because the vagus nerve, which is your rest and digest, is down there stimulating the heart to slow down and chill out. And those two together equal a low blood pressure. Now, the typical thing that happens here is that initially, you feel it's sympathetic activation. So the first thing that happens is your adrenaline goes up, your skin vasoconstricts, you get pale, you sweat, your hair stands on end, you get a little queasy, and you start to hyperventilate. Now the hyperventilation is triggered by the epinephrine, but it leads to low carbon dioxide, which constricts the blood vessels in your brain, which will decrease the blood flow to your brain and make it harder, make it more likely you're going to pass out, because it's the brain not getting enough blood that causes you to lose consciousness. Now, if you feel a faint coming on, there's things you can do, and I'll come back to this. But holding your breath and bearing down is actually very helpful. Don't hyperventilate. If you start to feel like you're going to faint and you're like getting that urge to take deep breaths, don't. You know, hold your breath. It will help starve your brain of oxygen, and that will stimulate vasodilation in your brain and overcome the vasoconstriction from the adrenaline.
Wow.
So your it's basically arm wrestling and compensating for a reflex that's not a good reflex in this context. So the sympathetic activity goes up, and then it shuts off, flash, boom, and the blood pressure crashes. And that is the dominant thing that causes you to faint. The low heart rate, which is coming from the parasympathetic, you can block that with atropine, which is a drug that blocks the parasympathetic, and you'll still faint. It's really the collapse of the blood vessels, the vasodilation in your vascular bed that leads to the faint, and it's very rapidly. Fight or flight switches off, your cardiac output drops by 50%, your cerebral hypoperfusion causes your vision to dim, the sounds get muffled, and you're down. So, as I said, when you get punctured, and the first few times it happens, children don't faint, right? When you give a baby a shot, they scream. They get sympathetic activation, but they do not faint. It's just, it's not a child phenomenon. It's a young adult phenomenon, and older adults will also have it. But it really is, it's the quarterback on the, that's the high school quarterback that faints. And not the little old lady, really. Not from that, anyway. But the one thing I want to get to is that there are things you can do physically that will take care of this faint. So people who get faint a lot should perk up their ears and listen, because there are some cool things you can do. And one of them is crossing your legs and tightening the muscles. That is the most effective thing to do. Cross your legs, either at the ankle or the knee, and just tighten up your legs. And what that does is it forces blood back up into the system. So you've essentially constricted some of that vasodilation. So you've squeezed, like wringing out a washcloth, you've squeezed the blood out of your legs and sent it back up to your brain by just crossing your legs and tightening up. Another thing that's really helpful is squatting. So if you drop into a squat, the same thing's happening. You're folding your legs. You're squeezing the blood up into the inferior vena cava and sending it back up to be beat around and up to the brain by the heart and recirculated. So you're eliminating the big problem, which is the blood diffusing out into this vasodilated vascular bed. You're overcoming the vasodilation mechanically, in other words. Now, you can, crossing your arms, push, you know, the old we must approve our bust exercise can help, but lower body works much better. I used to have my patients who were fainters, older patients who, when they stood up, they would feel a little queasy, a little woozy. I'd have them have a grip strength thing, like you've seen that grip monitor we have in the office. But the little spring thing that, you know, you can use to build up your muscles. And I would just have them squeeze it like 10 times. And that is enough, actually, to kind of break the whole reflex.
Wow.
And, of course, don't go get a blood draw when you're dehydrated.
No.
So that's a mistake a lot of people make because they're fasting.
Oh,
and
I never
thought
of that.
And they don't. It's like, no. You get to drink 3 glasses of water before you leave. And they have a bathroom at the lab. You'll be fine. Let's do one more question.
All right. Let's go ahead and do, when is cortisol good and when is cortisol bad?
This is an existential question. I liked it because it's philosophical. So good cortisol, bad cortisol, it all depends on the dose and the circumstance.
Mm.
So cortisol is both good and bad. It's very zen, my child. It is good until it is bad. That is pretty much it. You need that cortisol every morning for that circadian rhythm. It's critical. Without cortisol, you die. If you had absolutely none, you could not live. And it is really, it's just like, if I'm thinking about a computer system, cortisol is the operating, is part of the major operating system for all of your hormones. Without cortisol to respond to the instructions from the brain, it's the effector. It's the thing that sends the signal and coordinates all of the signals so that they don't clash with each other and step on each other. And you get lovely things like menstrual cycles. If your cortisol is messed up, your periods stop. If the cortisol is too high or too low, nothing. And so the ovaries need the cortisol to be being produced, and they need the adrenal glands working. And the adrenal glands actually produce a fair amount of the sex hormones, particularly in women who are and it comes from cortisol, effectively. It comes from the raw ingredients from cortisol. But it's really important to treasure your cortisol and be kind to your adrenals. Pet them every morning with a little relaxation, a little gratitude, a little I'm safe, I'm happy, I feel great. And not too much exercise, but definitely not too little. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.